Hello, this is Peter Davison. You're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
This is Gallifrey Public Radio, a weekly podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of Doctor Who. We travel through classic and new episodes, explore the extended universe, and play a few games from time to time. We do discuss news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but we'll warn you before anything considered spoilers comes up. Welcome to episode 419 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we're caught in a recursive space-time loop, but it's okay, because Julie is totally sure that she can pilot us out of here. I mean, she found the index file, the IF. I'm Kier.
I'm Haley.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Julie. This week, Peter Davison has the daunting task of defining a wholly new persona for the Doctor as his regeneration goes a bit wonky in Castrovalva.
Yes. We're finally there. We have emerged into a new era. Not for the cast, just for the show. Not the show, the show we talk about. And it's, I'm glad we're here. Castrovalva being the lead-off story of season 19, we have already been introduced to the sort of the stylistic changes of the John Nathan Turner era as showrunner, but now he's got pretty much a new house across the board, with the exception of some of the controlling characters behind the scenes, like Christopher Bidmead, who wrote this one. So we'd like to get some kind of initial reactions to the story writ large and how we feel about it. I will just say that I am so glad that we are here because this is one of my personal favorites, just within the Davison era, but even across Classic Who, this is really high on my list for a lot of reasons. So I'll get into them momentarily. But Haley, what was your take on Castrovalva as your introduction to the Fifth Doctor?
Yeah, this is my first Fifth Doctor story. This Davison guy, I think he might have a future. I enjoyed the story.
All right. Yep. She saving all of her cards for later in the discussion.
Right, top line reaction, that was a line.
Fair enough. Jay, how familiar are you with Castrovalva as opposed to like the Legopolis lead-in and those things?
So I've seen it once before, I think. And okay. I didn't remember nearly as much as I thought I would. I remember the scarf being torn apart. I remember bits of the Zero Room. And I remember everything collapsing in on itself with all the visual effects at the end. Apparently, mm-hmm. That was all I remembered.
Okay. The salient points. Right. The really critical stuff. Like, why are they right. here and why are they in danger? Yeah.
Got no, it. That's all ancillary. Yeah.
All right. Julie, this was, I believe, your first full Fifth Doctor story?
This is my first full Fifth Doctor story, but I've seen and or heard about this story in some of the reviews that they did for, I think, the 50th.
Yes.
For the 50th. So I've seen glimpses of it, but I didn't understand what the full story was or why it was going to be this way, and I really enjoyed it, both for the storytelling and the acting was great.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's pry open the cabinet and find out a little bit more about what we think of Castrovalva as a tale.
There was a very good polygonal Zero Room under the Junior Senate block on Gallifrey, widely acclaimed for its healing properties. Romana's always telling me I need a holiday.
But Romana's gone, Doctor.
Gone? Really? Did she leave a note?
We said goodbye to her at the gateway. Don't you remember?
Oh, well, if we did, we did. This should get you back to the console room when the time comes.
Are you sure you're all right?
There are strong dimensioning forces this deep in the TARDIS. Tend to make one a bit giddy.
And the regeneration?
I don't know. I can feel it isn't going to be as smooth as on other occasions. sooner we get to this Zero Room place, the better, eh?
As I mentioned a minute ago, Christopher Bidmead was writing this one just as he wrote Legopolis, so he sort of handled the bookend of the transition of the Fourth Doctor out, Fifth Doctor in, which I think is a storytelling advantage, something that we would expect showrunners these days to grab a hold of. And it kind of tells me to a certain degree that Bidmead, we talk about JNT being the showrunner in essence at this point in Who, but that title didn't really exist, or that sort of all-encompassing control didn't exist. It was still executive producer, but it didn't have as much of the hooks into the story editing process as we would expect a Stephen Moffat or a RTD or even a Chris Chibnall to have in modern parlance. So do you see some similarities as far as, and we remarked on this last time we did our rewatch of Legopolis just a couple weeks ago, in the way the story rolls out and how it's metered out to the audience, that that is sort of shades of where the show is at this point in its development?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, like I said, I remembered the actual like city of Castrovalva, or town, or whatever you want to call it. But you didn't catch a glimpse of it until what was it, the end of the second episode? Beginning of the third, I can't remember, but it's
trying to climb up the mountain. Yeah,
yeah, and I'm sitting here like watching all of this, and I didn't remember much of it all. I'm like, maybe I was thinking of the wrong episode. Like the there was a lot of story packed into this, and that's, you know, that's something that we've mentioned with Legopolis, is that there was a lot of stuff that actually got metered out at a decent kind of rate. So I enjoyed the fact that it wasn't all like, oh, we're in this spot and now we're just doing the power swap thing two or three times an episode. Because that's been known to happen.
I was thinking that as we were getting into like the second part, because watching just the first part of the story, I was like, oh, we're going to have like a bottle episode in the TARDIS to introduce our new Doctor. Because usually, you know, where the story starts is where the story ends. And, you know, you've got some zigging and zagging along the way, but you don't get too far from where you are. And into the second story, it was like, oh, this is a story where we're actually going to progress as we go from episode to episode.
With a distinct reason to be there. I mean, yeah. Grant, you literally read it off the screen. As the Doctor needs to go someplace for some R&R, you need to go place where there is a sort of a measurable level of serenity and peace. Go see Castrovalva. Like, it was blinking on the screen. Like Castrovalva, right. Be a good place to go. Go here.
Almost as if they were led there, yeah, or something.
Almost. Oh, no. Don't tip your hand too early.
I agree with everyone. I think that the breaking of the story and the pacing of it was very poignant. And I liked how it sort of gave us a little bit each time so that it didn't feel like a round and round, which is funny because that's what the... it was like a Pac-Man town where you go in the apothecary and you come out the bottom, and then you go to the right and you come out the left. So I...
Seamless tiles.
Yeah. So I really appreciated that, and it made for the transitions felt like they mattered instead of 2 minute long, like, yeah, that was a slow development. It was like, oh yeah, that's right. Okay. Jumping right into it because you knew that it was going to progress. You needed that anchor point, and then it continued instead of just being a stretched story. It felt very packed.
Right. I don't think there were a lot of scenes that felt like they were being particularly forced into stretch mode. It doesn't say that the end of this, that practice is not completely gone off the table yet. There are some times where you just have to, oh crap, we only have 21 minutes and 30 seconds and we need 22 and 10. Let's have another pensive look or whatever. Let's look at this hallway from a slightly different angle.
That doesn't bother me as much as we have enough story for 2.5 episodes, but we're still going to do 4, which we get... fairly often, so, in Doctor Who.
I'm okay with a little amount of padding. The fact that we're not getting 3-minute shots of K-9 trundling down a corridor is fantastic.
Yeah, I felt even some of those shots that would have been the K-9 trundling shots were, they meant something.
Yeah.
Well, so you got them, the carrying of the case through a few hallways, yeah. the shuffling mm-hmm. of the fabrics in when they're like, you took this. Mm-hmm. And even some of the re-angling of the shots. And then at the end with the, it kind of went digital and then it went puzzle piece and then it went.
Right, when it was collapsing in itself. Yep.
Yeah.
Even more than like some scenes getting fattened up. I'm talking about like, the story blocks that get looped because it's like,
oh,
you've captured us. Now we've captured you. And then at the end, haha, the tables have turned again, and we've captured you.
Right.
Like that not being a part of the story was nice.
I think a lot of that was actually eliminated because of the fact that in Bidmead's script, you don't have that sort of the warring factions thing wasn't mm-hmm. even there. Mm-hmm. Right.
True.
So a lot of times that convention gets put in there so that you've got,
instant the doctor conflict.
Right.
The doctor's dealing with this obvious on-the-surface conflict between these tribes or these species or what have you. And all the while, there's an extra baddie in the wings that we're going to see somewhere around the end of episode 2, beginning of episode 3, and then everything just takes a left turn.
Yeah.
That has worked for decades, but you really need to change it up every once in a while. Yeah. Well, worked. It has been worked. How about that? I missed a word. It's been worked.
Overworked.
For
you overworked it.
Yeah. Bake off reference. But Bidmead has always said that he was there. One of his primary points of interest was making sure that the little bit of hard science was in there and just a little bit of interest for those who were looking at this a little bit more on a cerebral level. Right. And if they're not going to hold on to things like chase me, chase you. I've got the torch of power. No, you got it. Oh, crap. I got to get the torch back. Only runs itself so far. What I've noticed was when he decided he wanted to put some science into this, playing a little bit with the idea of looping time and dimensional realities and so forth. I don't really know what was going on between the master trying to get into Adric's brain and using his maths to manipulate reality. That block transfer computation is still a little...
Did it make anybody else think of Bitcoin?
Just a bit.
A little bit, yeah.
But he's in my web.
He's in the web, yeah. He's stuck up in the scaffolding. So clearly I have him under my control.
Also, he has a mute button now.
I did say... You talk about those scenes where you could tell they were just adding a few extra seconds. Putting Anthony Ainley on the crane and moving him up to look at Adric at eye level... Like two or three times, like each one of those, you're like, just once. I want to hear the machine go clunk and shake a little bit. But no. When it came down to some of the scientific elements that were being written in, the idea of having to jettison rooms for thrust, I thought was a really interesting and dangerous concept to us as far as what we understand as canon.
Well, yeah.
Also, haven't they reused that recently? I feel like in the last. I don't know, two or three seasons. I feel like that was repeated as a possible plot point.
It has come up. I can't remember exactly where, but I know I have heard it in New Who.
Did they sort of mention it, or was it an actual option? Was it a thing that got riddled off as a, that one time I
don't know. It just sounded like something I had heard before.
Yeah.
I think it was like somebody listed it as an option for something, but I can't remember. But this is not the first time I've heard that.
Okay. So.
But I love the idea of the fact that when they're doing manual override on this and they're just plugging things in based on index file, the IF. What about the word if? A great scene.
Somebody taught me if.
that
kind of if.
That it could be the console room. It's totally random. There was a lot of mention of randomness.
Mm-hmm.
Through this whole story. You know, that's the trouble with regeneration. You never know what you're going to get. Doctor's like a box of chocolates and so on. I thought that was a really cool idea and something that adds some genuine tension without having a mustache twirly villain involved. This is just the system could kill us.
It's them versus a chaos theory that you never know what you're going to get. And I don't think we get enough of that sometimes. Because science is risky and they don't have a chance to test and adjust and do it again. And it's push the button and go.
Right.
It is sort of you adapt and you adjust and see what you can do next, which they did a good job of.
Mm-hmm.
little did they know that they were sort of being guided and they weren't going to make it anywhere anyways. But, right. you know, I think that they, in the face of that adversity, they did a good job.
It says something, it says quite a bit for our companions in that particular scenario.
They stayed positive and they kept thinking through the problem instead of letting it just get them down while the doctor was in and out of being able to assist them.
Right.
They always looked to him, and this time they had to take care of him.
Yeah, and this is their first actual day on the job, too. Like, before this, true. They were just kind of like running around on Earth. They weren't full-blown companions yet. So, you know, first day as a new hire, having to take over the ship. Mm-hmm. They did a pretty good job.
They did a little bit on Logopolis, though.
They did. They established some of their strengths. Like, we've seen enough of these characters now. We saw enough of Tegan in Logopolis to know that she craves on structure, mm-hmm. And order and instruction and following. You know, this is the guidelines. This is what we're supposed to do. She's a flight attendant. You know, this is what they do. They have to go through all these protocols, right? That's what they're trained mm-hmm. for. Adric is a mathematician, some sort of crazy advanced mathematics that somehow alters reality, but hey, it worked on Logopolis. Bah! And Nyssa is, for all intents and purposes, like an inventor, tinker, scientist, right? Mm-hmm. She understands scientific method.
She's the gnome.
Yeah, she's the gnome in your party. For any of you who get that reference, plus two to you.
I was irritated with Tegan in the whole, you know, evacuate the, you know, jettison the rooms thing, because she's like, but what if we jettison the control room? We're going to die if we do that. And I'm like, there's 100% chance you're going to die if you don't. Like, I understand your hang up, but she held on to that point for far too long. And it was just, I just wanted to like grab her and be like, no, it's fine. Like, this is your only chance at survival.
Don't you always run into people like that, though?
Yeah.
Both in storylines, but you also see people that they see the immediate concern.
Yeah.
But looking at long-term concerns is just, that's you have to take care of this thing in front of me first before I can even comprehend what's out there. So I get that. Is it easy to work with?
No.
but thankfully you got Nyssa to sort of temper that a bit. Nyssa, however, not terribly good at climbing out of a river.
That was such a funny moment.
That face that Sarah Sutton made I was gonna has say, been she looped just... on a gif so many times.
Had a great pout.
I'll bet it was either she had to try it so many times to get that perfect, what they were looking for on camera, or that was her first and only shot. One, yeah. And if they didn't like it, too bad. That's what you get.
Yeah, I'm not putting on another pair of wet velvet pants. The big thing here, the big takeaway, well, it's a big takeaway. The big thing we have as consistent viewers to chew on here is a new Doctor's portrayal. Granted, a bit wobbly at times, most of the time, but then, you know, hits a groove and we get shades of what the Fifth Doctor is going to be. How do we feel about this very young, very spry, sporty Doctor, as opposed to a baby Doctor or any of the other Spice Girls?
First impression, he does a passable Third Doctor impression and a really good Second Doctor impression. Yeah,
there's a reason for that. Troughton was his doctor.
Yeah. It was just, that was the moment where I was like, oh, wow, he is doing really good with that. Like, yeah. I didn't catch it the first time because I wasn't as well-versed in Classic Who, but, like, watching it this time, I was like, is he trying to be Pertwee there? Oh, no, yeah, now there he's Troughton. He is very much Troughton.
I wonder if he was really trying to. I know we've seen behind-the-scenes footage where he said he didn't want to try and channel them. I mean, you can't help, though, have influences if you were a viewer from mm-hmm. childhood. It's there. Yeah. I mean, the character's in your head. But it didn't help the fact that they kept having him refer to his past companions. I guess that's probably something that throws you off when you start yelling for Joe or Jamie or Vicky. Yeah, that's problematic. But Haley, how'd you feel about him?
I like him so far. I feel like the first story with a new doctor in it isn't the fairest to judge them by, because the confused regeneration is something that we've seen more than once, or like, you know, the sleepy regeneration or whatever. Like, sometimes the doctor just needs a nap after getting a new body. So I'm looking forward to seeing the next one more so than this one.
Excellent. Yep, good point.
I'm on the same sort of thought process as Haley, where I know that maybe the last episode and a half and maybe bits of it throughout, but we didn't really see a whole lot of how he's going to play the Doctor. And I will be interested to see how that last few minutes of... I think what I remember is sort of a more athletic, like you were saying, younger Doctor. So seeing that sort of hut two, you gotta run to the TARDIS. I think we'll see more of that theme throughout. And I think the happiness and some of those more positive traits will carry through. And I am interested to see how that develops into a more well-rounded Doctor instead of the falling over on a wheelchair, being carried. Although he did a good bit of climbing and like running around too when he was able to. So
That's true. We haven't had much of an opportunity for him to share screen time with the three of them at once as well, too.
Literally just that end bit,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah. So this is going to be the largest TARDIS team we've had in some time since the first Doctor, when you had Barbara Ian and Susan. Right. So
yeah. He also, because of not having drapey robes, I feel like we're going to see a lot more of the action. Mm-hmm. In him, just based off of that, too.
Yeah.
No possibility of accidentally stepping on your own costuming.
getting caught in a door jam or anything, yeah?
Yeah.
Any injuries are your own lookout at this point. You can't blame it on the wardrobe department, I guess. So we have a great reveal in this. I think it's granted, even though you're kind of playing a lot of the same game you did when you came off of Trocken and getting Legopolis, but this was executed, I think, brilliantly. And I want to get everybody else's thoughts on what happened when the Master finally reveals himself in episode 4. Caught Julie by surprise.
I did not see it coming. I knew something was up, but I thought it was going to be the librarian. And so I wasn't watching for...
Classic misdirect.
Right. I was watching for a different character to be the one that was going to catch them on the way to see this guy catch them out, especially because it was sort of, I think because of Trocken, I was expecting the old man to be the seer, the positive one. And even though he did not turn out to be that way, I still did think that.
Yeah, no, I completely forgot that the Master was in this, and I had no clue, and I was in the same boat. Like, they did a really good job of pointing towards Librarian at, like, look how nefarious he is. Like, he doesn't play by the same rules that everybody else is, and they did a good job of painting him as the villain to the point where, like, he was the only one in dark colors. Mm-hmm. You know, you had the villain in all white, so...
Right. Yeah. There was a great line, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I can't remember it, but there's a point where the Doctor is talking to them, he's talking to the assembled people of the Castro Valvins and saying, it's wonderful to have some time to interact with people that aren't nefarious evil monsters out to whatever, conquer the galaxy or something. And just then, the librarian walks through the door. Like, oh, man. Not the portrait, our gentleman in black. The thing with the Portreeb, though, and this was the kicker, because I kept the first time, obviously I didn't see it coming the first time I saw it, and the second time I spent all my time looking for the dropped hints, but there were none. Mm-hmm. There was like, I've now watched, I don't know how many times I've seen the story, there have never been any of those points where you see like that moment where someone hesitates just too long or something in the background shimmers or something to say, there's kooky crap going on here. None of those tipped hands. And the only reason why I was able to kind of, after taking some time away from the story, coming back to it and looking at it again, you cannot hide Anthony Ainley's eyes. He's got a very, very specific kind of set to his eyes. And despite all the other makeup that they put him in, and the fact that he's all hunched over and playing a perfect caricature for the Portreeb, just looking dead in his eyes like, yeah, okay. And that's why if you watch the credits for episode 3, they put his name in there for accredited as the Portreeb as an anagram. So they Anthony Ainley, they shortened it to Tony Ainley and switched it around to Neil Toyne.
Okay.
They, they weren't lying necessarily.
They were being wibbly wobbly about it.
And I love it. It's just another thing to love about this story. Did this feel the right amount of mastery as far as when he was telling Adric, I have a trap within a trap, and when the doctor was able to get away from, you know, the event horizon, or not the event horizon, but I guess they never called it the Big Bang.
Event one. They kind of hinted at it. I think there were traps within traps within traps, and I thought that was very mastery.
Very. Leaves nothing to chance. And no risk right now of kind of overdoing this new master right off the bat. We're not going to run into another issue of the third doctor running into the master for five stories in a row. Right? Nobody's feeling we're getting overmastered.
We don't know yet if that's the risk.
Okay.
Like, you can't overmaster one story, I don't think. But it's when it's like, you can. But that didn't happen now. I think it becomes an issue when you do it, you know, third doctor style five times in a row. Mm. And it's like, oh, it's the master again. Okay.
That's the thing. Like, the fact that this was like two in a row kind of makes you think it's like, okay, it wasn't too much, but if they continue down this path, then yeah, it's going to start to get frustrating. But I think this was the right amount.
Right. Well, because this is kind of a continuation of the last one. It's not like it's the master's next plot. It's like still on the doctor's tail.
Right. It's technically third, though, right? Because we had the Keeper of Trakan brought him in.
Oh, yeah.
So
true.
I liked how they kept the master's TARDIS as the pillar for the first two episodes of this series, this story set, because you knew that that was still him. And
that's like his go-to.
It's still, well, and I feel like he's definitely, he needs the time to figure out what is my next step. And it seems like, and maybe because we've never seen him change it, but it seems like from what the doctor would have had to go through, that maybe it's not the easiest thing to plug it right in and say, I want the TARDIS to be that. He sort of had to land on a thing and then make it that. But him showing up, a pillar is still something that you would see on Earth. So it is still very earthly, even though it was from Legopolis. Mm-hmm. And then you still get that sort of hint to that, saying the master is still planning something. He is focused. He is pinpointed on what is the next step, and he has to be, because this is all presumably rolling in real time for him. Mm-hmm. So I buy it that the TARDIS is still not top of mind to say, oh, I'm still hanging out in a pillar in this foresty land. Let me change to a telephone pole yet. But then changing it to the fireplace was clutch, and very much that is how you use a TARDIS properly.
Imagine how much more effective the doctor would be. Finally get the chameleon circuit fixed.
And I think I mentioned it on a previous cast too, that I respect that so much. And that is, we've heard stories even in the audios and other things where other users of TARDISes make it turn into all of these elegant different situations, and the master is doing it correctly.
Right, yeah.
Like, hide it right next to you so you can just step in and be there, or make it fit in so you can listen from right outside. It's just, I'm in awe.
He is awesome.
He is awesome.
Awful. Leaves us full of awe. Yes. Yeah. Well, any other, like, really, really gem moments from the story that stand out for you, ones that kind of give you that, oh, I'm either glad they referenced that, or that was a great exchange between characters, or anything like that?
I mean, it was a solid story. It was something, you know, I enjoyed watching it, but there weren't any other like standout moments of like, this is what made it memorable to me. Watching that scarf get pulled apart is always painful, but
it died for the right reasons.
Yeah.
But then to see him continue stripping because he ran out of that, you know how long that scarf was, and he ran out of it? How big is the TARDIS before they get to that point? And then he's dropping shoes and a shirt, ripping the shirt apart.
Half a vest, yeah.
Which is, I think, was a good segue into him changing his outfit. And I liked that he first saw the mirror And you see him look at himself, and I thought that was very interesting. Always the, like, oh, that's what I get moment. They always have it.
Yeah, the touching of the hair. Oh, my curls. Oh, yeah, no. Yeah.
And then I feel like the test it out, is this part of it? No, this isn't part of it. I liked that. I did notice the addition of the celery at the end, which mm-hmm. I don't know yet what it's for, technically. I mean, I've heard the rumors, but Kier told me to stop asking about it until we get to it at the whenever.
You, now that you've seen the story, you can at least have the fun fact that Davison hates celery.
And they made him eat it.
And they made him eat it. And it, there's a, one of the behind-the-scenes things where he says, thankfully, they cut the camera away so that I could spit it out onto the floor.
No.
And then they showed a little bit of civilization.
Hum, hum.
Yeah, spit. He bites it. No, but it's like, but he, you know how you never really know exactly how long they're going to hold a scene? So you have to, like, actors have to hold, like, expressions and reactions for right. a couple.
You have to act for a few seconds past the end.
And it feels uncomfortably long because you don't know, are you fading to black yet? Are you fading? All right. And he's just got to keep chomping and chomping and chomping. And finally, you see his face just dropping as he's chewing. Because that flavor, celery, man, that opens up in your face. And that's
yeah. If you well, also celery would be an awkward thing to eat on screen because, like, oh nope, I got like one of the long stringy bits.
I need some floss. I love some of the detail. I, you know, as far as particular moments in this, some of the meticulous attention to details on this, like take when the heat is building up inside the TARDIS in episode 2, and we have Tegan and Nissa both. Make a point of like every time as they're having conversation and they're discussing things back and forth, and one of them will turn over and try and do something on the console and react. That's cognizance. That's staying in the scene mm-hmm. and being attentive to that. But by the same token, you've got the fact that Tegan used her lipstick to mark down the walls as the heat was building up inside the TARDIS. Did you notice the lipstick was running?
It started yeah. melting, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yep. Little details
and
like that.
Even the lipstick tube had melted out.
Yeah. That's mm-hmm. those are the little things that I really, really enjoy, especially in older programs like this, because it shows that they were really kind of paying a bit of more attention to the science and just the craft of acting. So
I appreciated those moments as well. I thought they were great. And I liked the detail further in when they were actually in Castrovalva with, again, the mirror that was turned away, mm-hmm. the books, the different... Oh, yeah. Mentioning the age of the book, what stories were in them, those kinds of things that sort of carried through. And then paying attention to who was entering and leaving rooms.
Yeah.
And that it made a difference to the story and how people were reacting. Mm-hmm. I liked that.
And lastly for me, Tegan's landing. I still don't technically understand some of the physics behind the portal of the TARDIS and how it actually represents what is within the doorway, you know, stepping into a transdimensional space. But the fact that everybody's sitting at a 45 degree angle and she has to claw her way out the door, good on you, Jovanka.
I will say though that the scenes after that, like when they're in the console room and it's still sitting at the 45 degree angle, and you know that they didn't tilt the set. But everyone is like, you know, bracing themselves as if they're on a 45. Like, I was impressed with that because I had that moment of like, they're not actually like leaning. This is full on Star Trek shaky stuff. Mm-hmm. Like they're just selling it, and they were doing a really good job of it.
Yeah. The couple of bumps that the TARDIS took when it was Niga, Nissa and, oh my God, Nissa and Tegan. I'm going to do this through this entire era. Nissa and
when
Tegan.
They're together, you can just call them Negan.
Negan.
It's fine.
Negan, you know, with a baseball bat.
But it's a cricket bat.
They got that's a horrible
that's
crossover.
That's the UK remake.
That's a really, really bad crossover.
If it's all three, it's Nidrick.
Nidrick. Nistrick. This is descending rapidly.
Nitadrick.
But they would do a lot of their TARDIS bump scenes in perfect unison. So yeah. I think they had some good improv training.
I think so, too. And I think maybe they did like hopscotch playing together so they could be... jump ropes so that they were on the same
they're doing double dutch
rhythm. Yeah, double dutch. Yeah, they would probably be good at that.
For sure.
Adric is jumping because he's good at maths. He can time it right.
He times it right.
Right, yeah. So
poor Adric.
Why?
I just feel like he, you thought he was going to get away with it, but then he never got away. Like, he didn't get away from the master.
No.
And then he was strung up in that web.
But it gave him some really good emotional moments when he was really screaming back his defiance to the master. I mean, that was some pretty deep Matthew Waterhouse there.
Yeah. And I liked the appearance that he had to Nyssa. However, it was the master forcing him to tell her to not tell the doctor.
I don't even think it was him. I think it was all a projection because the master comes back and says it was a perfect likeness. And
I thought that it was the master somehow making Adric send the projection because Adric was controlling the whole of Castrovalva. I thought that was the point of it.
Might have used him to. Yeah.
I don't know how he forced him to do it, but some of the web bits were going in his ears or something.
Oh, it's with the remote control.
Yeah.
That's it. Well, goes without saying. I mean, we like to talk about how rewatchable and recommendable each of these classic stories is. I'm an open book on this one. It's pretty self-explanatory. But Julie, how do you feel about watching it over again and handing it to someone else as part of their, no, you really, you need this as part of your starter set?
I definitely think it's rewatchable. And I feel like as we're talking about it, there are some things that I feel I might have missed and would even rewatch soon to just kind of solidify it in my brain pan. And I think that if you skip this episode in any sort of, set of recommended watching, then you're missing a lot because it introduces your next doctor and a little bit of the interaction with all of these new players as they're really confirming how they react with the doctor and where they're probably, can't say because I haven't watched the rest of it, but probably where their base starts and then how their stories develop and what their character arcs will be with this doctor. And I feel like you'd miss something. And seeing, I always love the initial stories for doctors because you get them fresh and then you get to see how they grow. And that is really important.
Experimenting with the character too, taking some chances. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Jay?
I mean, I would absolutely rewatch this. I mean, it's one I've already seen before, and I enjoyed it then, even without knowing much of what went into it. I was looking up, like, you know, what classic stories does somebody need to watch, and this was on the list. So I was like, all right, I'm going to watch it. And I had no frame of reference, no idea what was going on, but, you know, it was still indelible enough to leave some kind of mark in my mind, even if it wasn't the important bits. But now kind of like having a better understanding of what goes into it, this was a really good story, and I would absolutely watch this again. And it, as Julie said, you know, it is important for people that this is the first Fifth Doctor story. You know, this is kind of setting up his era. This is really establishing some of the new companions and what their dynamic is going to be. And it's Ainley going full on, you know, scenery chewing master. So why would you skip it?
True. Scenery chewing and getting torn apart by the locals by the end of it. Check out my physique.
In a hallway too? It just feels like a weird place to rend someone.
Hey, that's probably more realistic. We don't always...
Depends where you catch them.
Yeah. You don't run out into an open field and get nabbed by 30 people of varying ages and ability levels.
It's when you're trying to turn the corner and catch the edge of it and slow down for a minute. That's what.
Yeah. See? Tight fit clothing. Keep you from having accidents. Once again, blame the wardrobe department. Haley, what's your thoughts on rewatch and recommend?
Definitely rewatchable. Like Julie said, I feel like I do need to rewatch it to catch the things that I missed on the first watch. And it was an enjoyable story to watch. I've started thinking lately about what I mean when I say recommendable, because you could recommend an episode for a lot of reasons. So I think this one you probably have to recommend. Again, it's like one of the big milestone episodes. You've got a Doctor's first story and new companions and stuff. But at this point, like, I don't know how representative it is of the Fifth Doctor's era. So it would be hard to say, oh, for a Fifth Doctor story, this is the one to watch.
Good point.
So, you know, with that caveat, yes, I think it is recommendable. But, you know, there might be better Fifth Doctor stories down the road that are a better representation for this group in this time period.
Yeah.
But to that note, I think it is a good story for what Doctor Who is, because you get a little bit of the Doctor, a little bit of the Master. You get companions mm-hmm. playing an important role, and you get some of the science that spans more than just a, we're going to say the same code word a few times and hope that, bloop, 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 you understand what that means, right? You heard about the event horizon, you watched the science sort of happen, and then you see, if you're paying attention and you like this sort of thing, you get what the recursive theories are. Mm-hmm. And so that is fun. And if you're looking to share that kind of story with someone, I think this is recommendable for that. I'm not saying it's the best one, maybe, but I think it's good for it.
Just to Haley's point, it may not be the quintessential indicative representation of Fifth Doctor at his best. But as far as if you want to get to know the Fifth Doctor, you kind of need to know where they come in the room. So,
and a regeneration.
Right.
Which some regeneration stories are not so great and some are interesting like this one.
You can't always have a cup of Jackie Tyler's tea. A little seed of something that I'm going to plant now that hopefully will reap entertainment rewards for the rest of us down the road.
No pressure.
None at all. Where we're basically putting a spotlight on the one individual who has not been able to join us for either of our two current installments of Whovian Mixology. So for all of her work obligations, Haley was not able to be here with us for either the Doctor's discussion.
Right. Work.
Work. There's big fingers.
Listeners, you can hear my quotey fingers, right?
And was otherwise obligated. I think sick. No, might have been sick. Sick for the first one. And then work obligations for the second one. We did the villains most recently. But we want to make sure that that we get to pick her brain on these as well. So we're putting a spreadsheet together that has all of our, mine, Julie, and Jay's selections for both of those installments. We'll leave a column open for Haley to be able to put in her entries for what she feels for these characters so that, as little bonus segments in episodes to come, we'll be able to say, you know what? Take us through your Doctor selections. Tell us why you did this. And we get a little mini drinking game whenever we want it. How could it possibly go wrong? So,
also, if we have any super honorable mentions from any listeners, get them in. I know we've gotten a few lists here and there, but if you have anything to add or something that you thought of as you go about life and have a new good drink that matches something, send them our way and maybe you will be included in the also Haley's extra little episode extra where there's more to share from other people also.
Haley's bartending sessions, basically. I'm still waiting on someone to topple my idea for a shot called the Probic Vent. So that one's still out there.
The challenge Nobody is still wants out. To even like broach that.
you don't wanna stick a finger into the never mind.
Hey, let's go to the news time. Oh, news. How about that?
Made quick mention of Patrick Troughton as we were saying, you know, Peter Davison's influences along the way. Just this past week, actually about 2 days ago as we're recording this, Fury from the Deep and its animated reconstruction, which is now available to you. It was available for pre-order before. Now you can actually get your Blu-rays and I think DVD box sets in hand if you still do the DVD thing. But it started airing on BBC America. So it's out there for your enjoyment in that regard too. Now, if you cut the cable and you don't have access to BBC America, and you think, "Oh, what streaming services?"
Sling,
which apparently is a thing, and there are a couple of others with even weirder names that I've never heard of. So, strange discussions about how they made the arrangements for who's going to carry.
But it's there, so go find it.
Yeah, or just order your Blu-rays. These are keepers. I mean, this was a great, great Troughton story, and it leads to things like the creation of the sonic screwdriver. And I mean, this is essential stuff. So add it to your library.
Highly recommended. Then,
yeah.
So two things: there's too many streaming services, and this site has some creepy ads at the bottom.
Oh,
that I was not prepared for.
Okay, yeah. Be careful about Be careful about some of the actual sources for the news links that we put in there, because normally I will grab whatever came up chronologically first. Yeah. Another thing that might be worth a little bit of an investment, either of your dollars and or your time. I'm trying both in very small quantities. Doesn't cost much. $3 American. And you can finally get Lonely Assassins, the new Doctor Who. I guess it's kind of a found footage game. It's from Maze Theory. It's the one we've been talking about that was coming down the pike with Osgood as your guide. And Lonely Assassins, obviously referring to your adversary in this whole thing, being the Weeping Angels, who have stolen or somehow abducted or come to the demise of a unit operative. And you, the game player, found this person's phone, and Osgood calls you and wants help finding them. So, great premise. I've played all of about 15 seconds of it so far. I like the format, and I'll have more on it after I invest a little bit of time.
I like Osgood telling me what to do.
Yes. That right there is a plus. I'm on board.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm good.
And I think if you have like, because it's also an AR game. So if it has access to not only your camera and your microphone, but also has access to your pedometer on your phones and things too, it'll tell you have to kind of move around, like, you know, check this room over, and you have to actually move the thing around. So that's kind of cool.
I just want to use my inhaler the same time Osgood does.
It would have then to attach to your health tracking on your phone.
It like restores some of her health.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Breathing better. Yes. Okay. Let's continue.
Last item to include is semi-spoilery if you don't like set photos. So skip it if you want to. But obviously we know Series 13 is filming. So it involves the Dangenda.
John Bish.
John Bish. Up.
And Jodie Witt.
Ticker.
Ucker.
So they appear to be
doing the filming, and that's where we're going to stop.
That's it. All we know from it has absolutely nothing to do with what they're filming, but just the fact that they believe that on their current timetable they're supposed to be wrapped up by July. So
post production, we'll see it early 2022.
I have no idea.
I
really don't know how they're going
to. I'm just going to throw it out there. Early 2022.
Or maybe the holiday special kicks off the series.
Could be. Yeah. And then just keep running straight through into the new year. Yeah. Would be. Yeah. We'll see. They just reiterated in the thing, because they were speaking really quickly with John Bishop, and he was saying, oh, yeah, you know, been friends with Chris Chibnall for a while. And he approached me a season or two ago and had this idea for the character for me specifically. And I was so honored, but I couldn't take it at the time because I was touring.
Life and stuff? Who does that?
But
Nobody anymore.
It just makes the Dangenda question mark even bigger. And Haley said offline before we got started, this guy had better be like the second coming. Oh, Julie said this, yes.
I don't remember saying anything like that.
Freaking amazing.
I have a high, high goal for John Bish. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, I don't understand. Mm-hmm. I still don't understand.
I think we said it before, but I haven't seen his comedy. I haven't seen anything he's in, but he just looks like a generic dude.
Yeah.
Like
D-O-O-D even, just dude.
Yeah.
So just
I feel like I could walk down the street and find like seven guys like him.
Yeah. So if you're listening, John Bish, just make sure you deliver, because we have high hopes and expectations.
Right. Come on the podcast. We'll do an interview to see if we think you're good enough to be on Doctor Who.
Thanks.
Yeah. What's your this X is what's factor, Bish?
And I hope you like being called Bish. Impressing
one thing, but impressing us, that's something different.
I like J Bish.
J Bish?
We should call him J Bish.
Nah.
Sounds like Hamish.
Right. Yeah.
So next week we are going to be crossing the streams a little bit, and for that Venn diagram of Whovians and D&D nerds where there's like a huge cross section in the middle, we're going to be messing with the character alignment chart and seeing where some of our favorite characters fall.
Some of these are going to be blatantly obvious. But I will make sure, I don't know, we could either all come up with some of our own and then just sort of fill in grids. you know, all doctors, companions, villains, and that kind of thing. Or we could just come up with a big list of characters and we all have to work with the same set and see where they fall on the axes. So what is it, what we feel would be the better approach? What feels more more game-like to you?
I think
everybody having their own grid sounds like more fun. Yeah.
Like a bingo card?
Yeah, we each have to fill our nine set grid.
I would say let's do two grids then each.
Okay.
Because there's some where
we
it's like...
We want to see where there's some crossover.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, we've each got two names for each spot.
Yeah, that works.
Okay.
Cool.
So we're going to fill our 18 grid.
That's not how math works.
Can we add a third axis to really make everybody confused?
I did this alignment cube.
Well, this has been episode 419 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I'm going to go take a nap. Where's the zero room again?
And this is Kira saying, Castrovalva, this is the town that never ends. Yes, it goes on and on, my friends.
And this is Julie saying, oh, that face, I hate it.
And this is Haley saying, I can't wait for the podcasting adventure where everybody has to carry me around in a box.
We'll see you next week.
I'll see.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Want to keep the conversation going? You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, or just send us a good old-fashioned email to feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also give us a phone call at 754-225-5477. That's 754-CALL-GPR, and you may hear your voice on a future episode of the show. Everything's got to end sometime, otherwise nothing would ever get started. Join us next week for a brand new episode.
Jacob Hansen. Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2021. We'll see you next week.